I wrote this script a while ago, and I was talking to, I have a lot of friends who are very well read in history. I have many friends who teach history at universities around here, and I texted one of them and I was like, "What is the Tyler Doctrine?" And so he gave me the Tyler. He goes, "You mean the Tyler Precedent?" And I go,
Nope.
no, Tyler Doctrine." He's like, "The hell is the Tyler Doctrine?"
Welcome back to the Buck Starts Here podcast that digs deep into the juicy stories, power plays, and wild twists that shape the presidencies of the United States. I am Kyle, the electrician to Eric's Mason, and today we get to see how John Tyler Jr. killed off whatever optimism was left after Harrison's early exit. Before we do that, though, and hats off to Joel for reminding me, I saw his comment like an hour before we were going to record. Laura had also mentioned this before we recorded John Tyler 1, and we never did it, but we're supposed to go back and recap. What actually killed Mr. Harrison?
Oh,
we left everyone on a cliffhanger and then forgot to resolve it.
Actually, do what? That's the running joke. You have to listen to the end of the entire series. Hold on, let me grab my notes for that.
While you're doing that, I'm going to workshop another idea for you, too. I'm going to call it the Harrison terrified. Challenge.
The Harrison
you have to listen to the entire catalog. Was it 32 days? 31 days?
31
How long
days
did his presidency last?
I think 41 days.
I think it was 30. It was in the 30s. It was only like 31.
Oh, it was in the 30s?
Yeah. But I'd say you get, if you can listen to our entire catalog from start to finish in 31 days, you get a Harrison button.
Do they make Harrison buttons?
Oh, we'll make one for that, I think.
Okay. Let's see. So, Kyle, what did you think it was?
I went with the simplest option. I thought your catch-all, all of the above, was too obviously a plant. What were the options? There's
it was
four
31
options total,
days,
right?
By the way. It was 31 days.
31
days, right.
Okay.
A pneumonia after exposure at the inauguration, specifically right lower lobe pneumonia, and exposure and fatigue linked to that to the inauguration speech. Enteric fever, which is just typhoid or paratyphoid infection contaminated White House water. Mixed. So typhoid mixed with a secondary bronchopneumonia. So in other words, he was strong enough to survive typhoid, but he got hit with bronchopneumonia and that weakened him too much. And then the last one, and this is the worst, not to give it away, but this is not. He died from a cold. He caught his quote. I'm quoting the newspaper. Caught his death at the inauguration.
Yeah, I don't think I don't remember what option I picked.
I thought you. Somebody go back. I thought you did the mixed causes.
I thought that the mixed was too obviously your trick. Maybe I thought it was a double bluff and talked myself into it. Joel went with option two. I know that.
All right. So the clinical infectious disease, the Center for Clinical Infectious Disease. And this is published in PubMed too. Like, well, PubMed's not a publication, but this is referenced in PubMed. Jay McHugh writes about this. He believes, and this is a 2014 analysis, he examined the doctor's notes and Washington sanitation data in 1841. And he argues that Harrison had a prominent gastrointestinal course accumulated in severe diarrhea. To the point of typhoid, likely caused by salmonella poisoning, acquired from the White House water supply. This is why I like this argument, the White House water supply was downstream from human waste dumps, known as night soil depositories. And in this reading, any pneumonia was secondary. So in other words, he developed salmonella, had a typhoid fever, and then the pneumonia was just something that he had.
Yeah.
I personally like this one, and as an economist, I'm going to have a weird reason why I like this one. So John Snow, who is like the first person to do something called a Snow diagram, you know you did something good when you're the first guy to do it.
Is that an angel?
Snow angel. he famously identified cholera as waterborne by mapping out things around the Broad Street pump in London.
That's okay. Yeah, I think I remember.
And this is around
the
same
time.
Yeah. So there is some people who mentioned it's cholera, but like that doesn't actually seem to. There's like no doctor I could find who was like, it's cholera. They're like, no, it's cholera would present different. They knew what cholera looked like at this time.
Right.
Not they didn't know what salmonella was, but they didn't make the difference between like the night soil depositories and downstream from the White House. Yeah. And then it was just he got hit with pneumonia. So, yes, I think some of his speech probably weakened him, made him more susceptible to pneumonia. Followed by
everybody pooping in the water supply upstream of
I'm just saying, if there's not people pooping in the water supplies, bad things are going to happen. It feels weird that, like, you know, sometimes a horse is a horse, right? Hooves are from a horse.
How long has it taken us to learn that lesson in history?
Like, honestly, up until like 170 years ago, and like not everywhere in the world right now.
I mean, 170 seems generous to me.
Dude, it's wild. Dude, sewer systems are the greatest invention, like a public health invention of all time. Sewer systems. It's like, I would say sewer systems and vaccines.
Yeah.
Then, hold on. Maybe sewer systems, antibiotics, and vaccines.
Okay, there you go. There you go.
Yeah, that's a tough one. It's those three, and I think it's a big gap between anything else.
Guns, germs, and steel. There's all a book on that, right?
Dude, right, yeah.
Well, let's make our way through Mr. John Tyler Jr. here, and I guess see where the redemption arc fails or falls
apart.
Yeah,
no, there's no reason. He hit the ground and just kept going.
I think you're taking us up to the election, basically to the point where he, assumed the vice presidency.
Yeah. So in 1841, he assumes the vice presidency, and he creates something called the Tyler precedent. And this is really the first time in history that we see the president have to take over for another president. It's a very weird situation. Like publicly, it was different back then, right? Because news didn't travel as fast. So there's this like misnomer that like everybody in the country immediately knew that the president died. In reality, they didn't. So William Henry Harrison died on April 4th of 1841. And it was only 2 days later that John Tyler arrived in, he wasn't in Washington at the time. So he gets recalled to Washington. And he ends up taking the presidential oath, just in his hotel room.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he just was in his hotel room. Judge William Cranch came in and was like, hey, he knew William Henry Harrison had died, but nobody knew what to do after a president died. So Tyler comes back in, and he gets sworn in by Cranch, and he immediately insists that he was president in full and not merely an acting president. And this is hugely important. I think we underplay how important this is because we forget about, there's one presidential death that I feel a lot of people forget about.
Mm-hmm.
And people are going to say, oh, it's William Henry Harrison or it's Garfield or it's McKinley. FDR.
Oh?
FDR died in office during World War II. Like he died in office while negotiating the end of World War II. The war was still going on.
Like, that's right, yeah. Huh.
And he died, and a furniture salesman took over. A furniture salesman who wasn't even on the original ticket when FDR first won. Somebody who's considered kind of a political outsider. He wasn't even from the East Coast. And then he ended the largest war of all time. Like, the largest war ever fought was effectively ended by somebody who was an elected president at the time.
Huh.
That's kind of wild.
It's like, Truman, right?
Yeah, Truman.
Yeah, yeah, and okay.
It all traces back to Tyler, is that idea that the United States does not have acting presidents. It has presidents. Everybody knows that.
What does the Constitution say about this? Or did it say at the time? Like, what happens when the president is no longer able to serve?
Oh, yeah. So there's two answers there. One, there is presidential succession in the Constitution, right? It's very clear. Tyler was 100% correct. But, laws don't apply until they're practiced, right?
Like that, right, yeah. You still have to go enforce the thing.
Yeah. You and one army. but the whole idea around some of the amendments we see, I believe it's I think it's the 25th Amendment, but I don't want to. Yeah, so I was right. It's the 25th Amendment. So there's the 25th Amendment, which basically, I'll read it, it addresses presidential vacancies and disabilities by clarifying the vice president becomes president if the president dies, resigns, or is removed from office.
The 25th Amendment, though, that was well past this event.
Was...
This was 1900s?
1965 it was passed. Well, it was submitted to the states, passed in 1967.
Okay.
But, what's another thing people talk about is, Harding.
Mm-hmm.
Harding was essentially had a series of, I believe, strokes. It's allegedly believed his wife ran the White House, ran the country. I mean, she would go into the room and confer with Warren and then come out and tell people that.
That should be a fun episode.
Warren Harding is the most corrupt president to ever assume office and ran with corrupted man ever. Oh, yeah. So we get a weird thing. We get like, I told you, I hate when people are like, oh, Woodrow Wilson's the most racist president. I'm like, no, the people who owned other people are the most racist president. That's not. It's Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson's the most racist president. I don't like Woodrow Wilson for many reasons, but I'm like, if you're going to create that hierarchy of like how bad of a person you are, like, I think we have to have that discussion. So Tyler sets this precedent. He gets in there. He's like, I'm the president. It's not acting president. And then he sets an agenda up.
Mm-hmm.
So like he begins acting. He's not like LBJ. You know, there's sometimes we look for, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And people are like, oh, is it like LBJ? It's like, no, he's not like not LBJ. I'm so sorry. He's not like Ford.
Okay.
Completely unelected,
and just happens to somehow become running the country.
Yep, and then Gerald Ford was like, "Hey, you know, I have that. I got the greatest mug of all time."
That was a gift, also sent in to me. The William and Mary School of Business.
School of Business.
Yeah, the Mason School of Business.
Mason School of Business.
I don't know why she sent it to me.
The moonshine in this country. So he gets in there, and what's funny is there are a lot of historians actually say that the reason I bring up the 25th Amendment is that a lot of historians actually say the 25th Amendment codified the Tyler precedent.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it was another interesting thing that came of that precedent was Tyler kept the Whig cabinet, so he kept Daniel Webster at Secretary of State. And allowed Harrison's already summoned special session of Congress to proceed in May. And then in his message to June to Congress, you know, he affirmed that though he had inherited like all of William Henry Harrison's cabinet and so forth, he was not an acting president. He was the president. He did not have to follow the Harrison agenda. But he affirmed his limited government principles, and he started pushing for, it was very interesting. So he started to signal, and I want to use that word very carefully, signal fiscal reform.
Mm-hmm.
But he would not commit to Henry Clay's core objective, which was a new national bank. So the whole country's like,
okay,
you want reform, but you won't back Henry Clay's national bank. What is reform going to look like?
Right. But did you also, I mean, you kind of glossed over that a little bit there, but when he said he is not an acting president, that he is in fact the de facto president, that sounded like that was him justifying his departure from Harrison's planned agenda?
Kind of. I will say Tyler, his entire campaign was always very up and open about his view of the role of the federal government.
We learned in the last episode, he's extremely consistent throughout his career.
Oh, yeah. You don't have to like him, but you know where he stands.
Right.
Harrison was a Federalist, even in his dying words. He talks about preserving the idea of the federal rule. I don't want to be overly simplistic and describe Tyler as anti-Federalist, because that's not fair to him. There's plenty of stuff to poke holes with him. It's like with anybody in history, any person today. But he was an anti-Federalist. He was a limited government person. So he believed in the power of the federal government, but he had this crisis. One thing he had a crisis of conscience on. Fine owning people, fine buying and selling people, right. But apparently like esoterical beliefs of how government should be structured. Oh, that's where you draw the line. I'm bad with that. I'm sorry. And so he had this idea of like, what does limited government mean? Because he wanted government to be out of people's lives. But in a sense, he didn't want the lack of government to be impeding people's ability to act. And mm-hmm. I think that's kind of an interesting line where I think even today there's people who, I think a lot of people discuss that. I think that's a very common thing to discuss today. And it's cool to see it being talked about 180 years ago of like, you know, can you have so little amount of government that becomes punitive?
Like
everybody always knows government overreach, but is government underreach then?
Just thinking, you'd think that we'd made more progress on it if we've been talking about it for this long.
Yeah, I know, right? I think, dude, in all fairness, I do think, like, we've made a lot of progress. I just think, like, we're the most pessimistic apes. Like, humans are the most pessimistic apes. It's all because at one point there was a ruffle in a bush, and one caveman went over and got killed by the ruffle in the bush, and the other caveman who ran away, he went on to have more kids, and you just repeat that process over and over again. Suddenly we're all anxious. We're all taking anti-anxiety medication, which is good. It's okay. We should do that. We should be positive.
Anxiety is what keeps you alive.
Yes. But also, if it's too much, talk to somebody. It's okay to talk to somebody. I don't want to make it sound like we're anti that. That's a good thing. Good movement in society has been talking about mental health. I would say that's been a net overall positive. Antibiotics, vaccines.
And mental health.
Mental health. I do honestly think it is. Why am I getting yelled at for this?
I don't know.
I think this is a very okay point of view to have.
Wondering why we're talking about this when we're supposed to be talking about John
maybe
Tyler.
Maybe somebody's listening out there and they're like, hey, do you know what? John Tyler reminded me to go talk to somebody. And I'm like, he has a win.
You're going to be so mad when that gets cut.
I'm going to be G. Laura, I trust you. All right, so, you know, Congress meets, they're in special session, they're called back. Nobody knows what to do. You know, it's been 70 years since the founding of the country. Nobody knows. They've been under the Constitution for 50-ish years at this point. And nobody knows what happens when a president dies.
Nobody's still alive who wrote the dang thing.
No, right.
Yeah, you're all gone at this point.
I'm sure somebody called John Quincy Adams and was like, hey, what would your dad done?
right?
But Congress, now you got to understand, this isn't Congress. Like, there's been times in history where we had weak Congresses, times we've had strong Congresses. This is arguably the strongest Congress in terms of individual people. Like, again, you don't have to like their politics, but you have the Henry Clays, you have the Daniel Webster's, you have John Quincy Adams. I mean, it's very rare to have a former president sitting in Congress. So. What happens? Well, Congress quickly repeals Van Buren's independent treasury system, which would eventually come back as the Federal Reserve. So the one good thing Van Buren did, we immediately forgot about. Then they sent they repealed everything. This got a little awkward because they knew how William and Henry Harrison was, and you know they saw some of the Whigs were like, oh, Tyler's a Whig. Well. You got to remember, Tyler was only on the Whig ticket to assure some of the Southerners that they could vote Whig, and they're not gonna lose that
their right to
Southern
own people.
Voice. Yes, yeah, kind of. They wanted to feel like they had a voice in the White House, I should say, but it would probably that voice was to advocate for slavery. So, what the Whigs end up sending up to Mr. Tyler is called the Fiscal Bank Bill. And it's basically this fiscal reform that kind of brings us to where we were pre-Jackson, but kind of not. So there isn't this real, what we'd call a national bank, but I guess we would call it a proto-national banking system, where it talks more about, and less about a bank being this operation that's involved in government and policy decision-making, but more, how is government going to manage its liquidity? There's many parts of the fiscal bank bill that gets in there. It's really kind of a series of different things. We mm-hmm. can really fall down the rabbit hole going down here. But it
let's because, go. I'm ready.
Well, I was going to say. Well,
I'm drinking tea all day.
Because we eventually have like the reestablishment of Van Buren's idea, and now that transcends into the what I would argue eventually transcends into the modern day banking system and the Federal Reserve. And this is this idea of the fiscal bank actually gets vetoed. It actually gets vetoed. So Tyler vetoed in August on constitutional grounds because he really did not like the idea of he does not believe the Constitution gave the federal government the power to charter a bank operating within states. And I think this is kind of interesting.
Not wrong necessarily, right?
I don't think he's wrong. I think if you're a strict constitutionalist and you look at it like, can a federal agency give a charter to a bank that only operates within a state?
No, that's a state's right issue at that point. Yeah. It should be, right?
Like, everybody knows Southwest Airlines?
Mm-hmm.
All right? Southwest wasn't FAA certified for a long time because they only flew within Texas.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's...
right.
I don't know. It's an interesting argument, and that's what you find a lot with Tyler. Like, there's parts of Tyler that morally... people today are uncomfortable with, right? But there's a lot of decisions Tyler made during his presidency that if you look at it through, is he sticking to what he's talked about doing his entire life and his point of view his entire life, he is consistent. He is not Jackson, or the Jackson of kind of Van Buren, but definitely Jackson, with that small tinge of hypocrisy kind of in every single thing they do. Certainly Jefferson has a large dose of hypocrisy. Yes. He is interesting because he is just very, very consistent. And he ends up becoming quite, I don't want to say like liked by Congress, but Congress also eventually is like, guys, he's not like he's lying. He's not talking out both sides of his mouth. He's literally telling us exactly what he will pass, what he will sign. It's like, we can't then be angry at us for submitting something to him that he told us he's not going to pass. So Henry Clay and a bunch of other reps get together and they're like, hey, let's like, you know, repackage this. So they, he barely gets it repackaged. And the idea is called the Fiscal Corporation, which is like a watered down version of the fiscal bank bill. It has more to do with this, again, kind of interesting view of like being able to interact with banks and how the federal government is able to create continuity among how it issues payments and receives payments. And instead, that's going to be overseen by a bank, but a corporation bank. And what I mean by that is literally what the word corporation means. Like, hey, do you want, we get it, Mr. Tyler, you don't want one charter, you don't like the idea of the U.S. chartering this. How about we just have a system of banks that are administered within each state that create the corporation that we then manage our money through? And so Henry Clay is like, he's definitely going to sign this. Like, this, we figured out all the stuff. Goes to Tyler. Tyler vetoes it in September. So I got veto. Fiscal bill gets the fiscal bank vetoed in August. This gets vetoed in September. And at this point,
mad?
Dude, they flipped out. They absolutely flipped out. It was explosive, man.
What was his reasoning for vetoing that? That sounded like exactly what he wanted.
He can't get over the idea of government even passively endorsing a bank.
So just the fact the government's involved at all in this banking issue.
I do often wonder how Tyler thought money should, like, see, one thing I don't like is like, we have understandings of modern banking, right? Like, every recession's always different, even though a lot of the mechanics are the same. But every recession's different because we learn. We learn. We forget that humans are smart and we learn. So like, the dot-com bubble is different than the housing bubble. Both bubbles, but what caused them is different. Now we have all these new rules and regulations, and you know what we're trying to do is create better information flows through economies through pricing, and you see that in interest rates, right? So like, my question is like, and I couldn't figure it out. What did Tyler think was, like, what? How did he want to manage the money?
Like, it didn't make any sense. Like, where are you going to stick the taxes and the tariffs and other revenues that you're collecting on a federal level? Where does that go then? Is it just chunks of gold that you're going to stick in Fort Knox?
Yeah, like, I don't support Andrew Jackson's view, but I get his view. Like, I understand what he's trying to do. I don't think it's smart. I don't think it was constitutional, but I get what he was doing.
There's no real logic to Tyler's. Right? It may have been bad logic that Jackson is following, but at least there is logic.
Like, he's so committed to this idea of limiting federal overreach that he can't really agree to anything that's productive. He becomes such an absolutist. And like, a lot of times with absolutism in politics, it becomes useless.
Mm-hmm.
And the Whigs blow up. Henry Clay, they all denounce him. Every cabinet member besides Daniel Webster resigned in protest. wild move here. The Whigs caucus informally read him out of the party. So he's no longer, he's thrown out of his party. I want to be careful with what I say next, but I'm fairly certain this is the only time in U.S. history that happens.
Mm-hmm.
I'm fairly certain it's the only time that he's a president's removed from
a sitting president removed
from a sitting president.
Even Nixon.
So Nixon was the one was looking at.
Right. Yeah.
I don't think he was ever. I don't think he was ever caucused out of the Republican Party.
Still wanted his. Still wanted his word. His endorsements.
Well, he just left too. Like, that was Nixon. Like, he just left.
Yeah.
and was never impeached.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
It's a very weird one. I was trying to figure out. I was trying to figure out if Andrew Johnson was caucused out of the Democratic Party, but I don't think he was. I think it was a similar thing to Nixon, where he was like at the end of his, like at the end of everything. And he was
we're getting close to Andrew Johnson too.
Andrew Johnson would be a weird
much
one.
About him.
I'm very excited to do the Andrew Johnson because I do think it's interesting that he ran with the first Republican.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's kind of weird. The first Republican was on a mixed ticket. Like, it's weird. It's the first mixed ticket. It's the first mixed ticket, period. Some will actually argue that this election is a mixed ticket. I don't think.
I think this is pretty... I think there's a good argument for this election. You're talking about the John Tyler and Harrison election?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like they were both Whigs. Like, I feel like Tyler was a Whig because otherwise he wouldn't have been on the ticket. I feel like that's a big hurdle to get over.
I don't know. It's the whole slavery issue feels pretty sticky, though.
Yeah, that's true. And I'm with you. I'm with you. But William Henry Harrison had slaves, too. Yeah,
he did.
Because, like, we're just in that.
Because he could have been. He just could have been the greatest president, but.
Never.
No.
So, like, the let's just put a negative in front of the presidential score for morality.
Yep.
So the Whigs read him out. And so Tyler was like, well, screw you guys. And he just formed his own cabinet with all Whig loyalists. Oh, sorry, with all Tyler loyalists. The Whigs become openly hostile. and they just start going after each other. So basically Congress forms this caucus and end up fighting and maneuvering over revenues and tariffs and the scope of federal economic power. Like, what decisions are the federal government allowed to make? Yeah. But this leads to what's called the Divorce of 1842, where congressional Whigs actually realize how successful they're being. Like, oh, wow, if we all band together, we can fight the president. And it's not the first Congress versus president battle we've seen. The first one was really under Jackson Adams' time period that we really see people, Congress intentionally being obstructionist. Well, Henry Clay gets a bunch of allies together, and they attempted to tether tariff increases to a scheme of distributing federal land revenues to the states. And so Tyler, who's a strict constitutionalist, was like, I don't like this, like, you know, patronage system that's going on. So he vetoes a bunch of these iterations of this bill that combined high tariffs with a permanent distribution. And basically, he's arguing both policy and constitutional objections, where he's like, one, I think this is a bad policy. I think it creates, you know, we're just coming out of starting to recover from the Panic of 1837. So he doesn't like the policy of it. And then he's also arguing, like, the idea of, like, the federal government can, like, tax and get revenue, essentially, from land sales and then distribute it to states. Like, is it the federal government's role to do that? Which is weird because, like, Jackson was doing that for a while.
I mean, they kind of all have been doing that, I mean.
Yeah, right? It's been going on for a while.
Yeah. Mississippi?
This is the state of Mississippi, right?
Yeah.
So by late summer of 1842, Congress passed this is kind of interesting. So it's called Tariffs of 1842, but it's not really a tariff, right? It's this combination of I describe it as an omnibus spending bill, right? An omnibus bill, where it tries to address all these things. And so Congress has been negotiating with Tyler's cabinet for, at this point, probably like 8 months. And, you know, I've seen newspapers describe it as a bruising fight. Like, it's just attritional. But it passes. So,
wow. Yeah.
Like, even though, like, Congress has negotiated this and they're like, oh, you know, he could still vote this down. And we talked to him. Nobody thought it was, I mean, a lot of people didn't think it was going to pass. It ends up passing. And what ends up happening is the Whigs got their higher tariffs that they wanted, which obviously plays very nicely to most of their voter base. And Tyler is able to block what he viewed as an unconstitutional revenue diversion to states. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I don't want to say that's how Congress and the executive branch is supposed to work, but
it kind of is.
Kind of is how it's supposed to work.
Right?
But I think, and so as we close out 1842, Tyler has what a lot of people would say is kind of his, like, you know, his big international diplomatic win, which he actually successfully negotiates the border between Canada and Maine.
Oh, I forgot. This is still not quite solved yet at this point, too, right? There's still some dispute over, like, one of those areas.
Yeah, so, no, there is. I mean, that's why you have a border. The border line goes through a library.
So you're telling me he did a terrible job at that, too.
Well, I will say it was on the New Brunswick side, so I don't know if it includes all of modern Maine. But yeah, it's called so he sent Daniel Webster to negotiate it, and it's the Webster Ashburton Treaty. So in case mm-hmm. of any trivia question there. But no, it is really interesting because a lot of people did not think that that would ever that would ever work.
No. So, wild. So how did they get it past them? Did they end up having to, did you just not veto? Nope, or I guess they made the changes enough that he was able to accept it. As long as they weren't distributing the federal funds to states, he didn't care.
Yeah, I think that was really what hung him up on it.
Yeah.
You know, in as 1842 ends, you start to see not this cooling. You don't really see, I don't want to call it a cooling effect because I don't think that's right to call it that. But you start, Congress and the executive branch begin to learn how to work together. And this is right as the year closes out with really the ending of the Second Seminole War. And this gets kind of curious here. And, you know, Kyle, you're a military member, so you might find this interesting. So Tyler signed something called the Armed Occupation Act, to encourage settlement and stabilize Florida's frontier. And it was part of this wider pattern of promoting Southern and Western development without erecting the kind of centralized financial machinery that he opposed. So just kind of open settlement. But it really is the beginning of Manifest Destiny that won't really take off until under Polk. But specifically outlined here is Tyler. And I remember Tyler worked for, you know, Tippecanoe. And we covered the Battle of Tippecanoe. And he kind of envisioned like this idea of like military intervention on these lands that he thought were U.S. territory, or was U.S. Florida's case, was U.S. territory, without doubt. But the idea of Tippecanoe, right, that idea of, like, we are going to go march the military into an area. And while there wasn't large spread opposition here, there was a question that popped up at the time. They were like, if you march an army into an area,
mm-hmm.
is that okay?
If it's, is it U.S. soil?
It's U.S. soil. It's territories.
Yeah, that seems a bit intimidative. Like, that's kind of, I don't know, but it's territories, though. It's a little, I don't know. That's right? Tough. Because it's the frontier. Like, it's where they're actually kind of needed. Like, there are skirmishes going on. You're really going there to defend. You're not going there to evict citizenry or to quell rebellions, right?
Yeah. Like, it becomes a very interesting question because of this decision. There's so many decisions Tyler makes in his, you know, obviously less than a term presidency that we see, like, echo throughout history because this whole idea of this armed occupation really sets the groundwork for the bloody Kansas-Nebraska, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that idea that, like, you pick up your weapons, you go, and they're like, hey, when it comes time to vote for statehood, you're either free state or slave state, and you're allowed to be armed.
right.
it is weird that we don't talk about, like, bloody Kansas as a civil war, because it was a civil war.
Yeah, the way you just described that, that sounds a little more...
They just killed each other.
Yeah, it sounds a lot different than they taught it in school.
Yeah.
We're just going to send some people up there to vote and intimidate. Like, yeah. What does that mean, intimidate?
And then John Brown was like, bat.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't... I think it is weird that it doesn't get talked about more of like a civil war.
Well, we can fix that.
Yeah. We should do an episode on Kansas, Nebraska. There'll be two presidents from now.
To petition a bonus episode for Henry Clay at some point, too.
Yeah, I do love Henry Clay. I'm kind of...
He's been, like, in every freaking president.
I know this sounds bad, but I'm waiting for him to die.
Yeah,
I know. To be like that.
Yeah, it's okay. Episode.
But it's just like he's just been dominating politics for 50 years. He's the most important politician to never be elected president.
Do you think we could cut an episode of Henry Clay using just all the times you've mentioned him in every other episode?
Oh, yeah, you definitely could.
That'd be
He's
impressive.
A complicated dude. He's a complicated man.
Yeah.
He's a complicated man. I think it'd be fun to talk about both personally and as a political figure that gets glossed over in history for some reason.
Like him and Webster. Probably have to talk about Webster, too.
Yeah, Daniel Webster's like another interesting...
He's been showing up quite a bit as well.
He was a great statesman.
Yeah.
Just, man, did he just, I mean, even some of the stuff you would read about him, like Daniel Webster, even if you didn't like him, people were like, wow, he's a very, not, he wasn't like realpolitik or somebody who just politics, right? Like, he was seen as a man with convictions, right? He was mm-hmm. seen as, you knew where Daniel Webster stood. He was just like really good at talking to you and being like, hey, we may disagree, but we agree on this one thing, and we need to, one thing we agree on, like we could work from there.
Right.
So he could build coalitions. For, he was literally
he's really good at finding common ground.
Yeah, he was like I don't know if it wasn't a Daniel Webster biography, but it was a book that had Daniel Webster in it. And the historian who wrote the book called him like he could build shoestring coalitions that could hold back a storm. I think he's just really good on it.
That's high praise.
In talking about Daniel Webster, one of the most notable events in 1843 is Daniel Webster resigned.
I thought you said he didn't. He was the only one who didn't.
He didn't resign in the original resignation of everybody. And so that really closed the last bridge to, you know,
Harrison
Whiggerianism. So I'm not joking. That's what it sometimes it's called. But that really closed the chapter to the Whig Party, right? Now there's no more Whigs left. They're all, I don't even know what you'd call them. Some of them, they're all Tyler Loyalists. That would be the word to call them. And so,
is it a new political party then? Kind of.
I mean, I guess you would call them like, I don't even know what you'd call them, like Southern Dems at the time. But they're not populous enough to be what the Democratic Party was at that time. So I'm hesitant to call them Democrats. They're kind of more like the Tylerites. we end up having kind of this, the last 20 months of his presidency are an absolute whirlwind, dude. So Webster resigns. He ends up appointing this guy, Upshur, who's very, him and Tyler are like friends. Like they're good friends. So he takes over Secretary of State, and gives him one directive. He wanted to orientate public policy towards territorial expansion, and he wants Texas.
Really?
Yeah. So Upshur. Upshur wasn't necessarily in the Hall of Fame as Secretary of State, but he was loyal to Tyler. He was intelligent by all metrics. I don't want to call him ruthless. I don't want to call him ruthless because I don't think he was ruthless, but he was very driven. He was very, very driven. And so he immediately starts going, starts looking at Texas, like, hey, you want to join us? And Texas is like, yeah. And obviously that'll lead to cascading effects.
I mean, isn't Texas still part of Mexico at this point? Is this before the secession?
Yeah, the Texas-Mexican War. I thought
that was coming up. Or no, it's the Mexican-American War that's coming up.
That's coming up with Andre.
That's California and all the other.
1836, yeah. So
Okay.
Yeah, you have the Republic of Texas of 1836. So Tyler tells Upshur that he wants Texas to join. Texas wants to join, but there's kind of this resistance to joining because like they're going to come in as a slave state. But also Mexico's like, dude, you just... feels like you
kind of ours.
Those hours. So that ends up being kind of a wild thing, that we'll see develop under Polk. But what Tyler ends up doing, Tyler also repealed the 1841 Bankruptcy Act because people just started abusing the crap out of it. So that was like the first time that like small businesses and effectively like individuals could go bankrupt in the United States. And people figured out like all these loopholes for it. And yeah, so he...
Sounds kind of contemporary.
Yes. And it was funny because like in some places we're super pumped to see it go away. And then a bunch of places we're super angry to see it go away. And it was like, I wonder who was abusing this.
Yeah, right.
Now, here's something funny. One of the last things that we see pop up on the international play outside of obviously Western expansion and the issues with Texas is the introduction of the Tyler Doctrine. And, you know, it's funny, when I wrote this script a while ago, and I was talking to, I have a lot of friends who are very well-read in history. I have many friends who teach history at universities around here. And I texted one of them, and I was like, what is the Tyler Doctrine? And so he gave me the Tyler, he goes, you mean the Tyler Precedent? And I go, no.
No.
Tyler Doctrine. He's like, what the hell is the Tyler Doctrine? And basically, John Tyler out of nowhere is like, hey, Europe, you can't touch the Hawaiian Islands.
Oh,
and Europe was like,
what? Europe has no access to that. That's in the Pacific.
Yeah. Europe's like, what do you mean? He's like, yeah, stay away from Hawaii. And they're like, okay. Like, there's no Panama Canal. It's like, do you think we're going over there? Like,
right.
So he's like, also all the Central Pacific. And they're like, what? Why do you have authority over the Central Pacific? He's like, stay away from Hawaii. And everybody's like, Okay, Tyler, you cool? You all right, man? You
all right
okay
over there? Where's Harrison?
Yeah. It would be really funny if you didn't hear that, like, Harrison died yet, and somebody's right. The new guy in America.
The first communication you get from him.
Stay away from Hawaii. It's like,
these are our pineapples.
Yeah. Oh, all right. Now I want Hawaii.
I know, right? Surprised. Is this why Japan attacked Pearl Harbor?
Yes, this was the reason.
This is exactly why.
Fun fact, you know our famous Article 5 of NATO, attack against one is attack against all? Doesn't apply to the Hawaii Islands.
No?
Yeah.
Why is that?
I don't know. It just was written out of, it's not, it's only Alaska, the continental United States.
Oh, because it's the only place in America that has been attacked. And they're like, you know, just in case lightning strikes twice.
Ooh. So he ends up like, I don't know why I find it so funny that he was just like, hey, don't touch Hawaii. It's like, why are you touching Hawaii? Like, what?
I know, right?
It's not near you either. And like, we don't really have states on the West Coast yet. Like, no, not California's a state yet. Like, it's 1850. It was 1850 that California became a state. So it's like, what are you yelling at, dude? Like, we also don't have an established border with Canada yet. Like, Polk will get elected on 5440 or fight. So, like, what are you talking about? Why are you picking that one? Like, how are you getting there? There's so many questions.
That was for his campaign reelection. That was his bullet point, was I was strong on Hawaii.
Yeah, they're right.
All right. Is there any other pieces of legislation? Anything else to cover? Anything in your notes here, or should we get to grading?
Yeah. So there's 3 points left. 3 interesting parts of Tyler's presidency that don't really amount to anything, but they set fires. First is he was actually
I love fires.
Right. He. So he ends up. He moves to open up China. Right. So he sends envoys there. He's really like, you know, really kind of pushing the idea of like China's this growing economy, but obviously there's influence from the Brits and stuff like that. We do see something called, it's called the disaster of the Princeton, basically in 1844. So we're coming into the end of his presidency. Mm-hmm. There's a celebratory cruise on the new steam frigate, the USS Princeton, where one of its heavy guns exploded and actually killed the Secretary of State, Upshur.
That sounds so familiar. The Princeton. Okay.
Yeah.
I think I remember that event. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's obviously that's a very interesting time in U.S. history. The Secretary of Navy and Secretary of State pass away. So his Secretary of State dies. He appoints John C. Calhoun. John C. Calhoun comes in here.
That's another name we need to deep dive on.
Also great. Just great name in general. John C. Calhoun. Yeah. And he comes in. He's fiery. He's like, he wants Texas. And he says, this question will be answered now. And it eventually results in them submitting to Congress in some of the last days of Tyler's presidency, Texas statehood, but leaving it to the next day, or the next president, I should say. It absolutely doomed his original like correspondence, and even his discussion with Congress. It is laden with sectionalism. It's laden with, you know, just, I don't want to say radical speech, but radical speech. This is very I don't want to say this is unlike John C. Calhoun, but this is clearly, if you look at the history of John C. Calhoun, this is a president, Secretary of State, who is convicted on this, which I personally believe he was driven by Tyler, but there's, many people who
considering the
that.
Previous Secretary of State was told to pave the way for Texas, I think that was probably a fair assumption.
Yeah, and even more interesting, I just want to throw this out here. So the first treaty ever signed between the U.S. and China was in July of 1844. It wasn't the Secretary of State who signed it. It was Caleb Cushing, who ended up signing the Treaty of Wanghai. Somebody yell at me if that's how you... I actually asked one of my friends from China if that's how it's pronounced, so I do feel fairly confident that's pronounced Wanghai. But again, I just want to... Like, anybody can yell at me with that. But it becomes the first treaty between the two. And it's when the U.S. actually gets its most favored nation status with China, is that wild? Then that would last for, you know, that would be a big reason. Our relationship with China would pretty much last 100 years from 1844.
When did it close down? Because I remember that being like a big deal when it got reopened in like the 90s?
it was under Nixon that we reopened discussions with China, but they didn't. China didn't move to a capitalistic. Deng, I think is how you pronounce his name, until he was the chairman of the Communist Party, and that was in the 90s. But it was after the Chinese Civil War, which I guess you could argue was still going on, but when Taiwan started. So, like, you know, 100 years later, you not 100 years later, but 98 years later, the Flying Tigers, the famous Flying Tigers, the U.S. volunteer troop that went over to, you know, fight the Japanese in the air on behalf of the Chinese. I mean, like that, this is the first, you know, link of these two countries.
That's wild.
So as we close out his presidency, you know, actually there's a lot of interesting stuff that's happening around this time period, but, you know, we do see Tyler in his last push, right? What he does is that he pushes to get Congress to annex Texas because he recognizes the economic and the society benefits of the country, all that stuff. Basically, the Senate can't get on board with it. Mm-hmm. And so Tyler actually does something very diplomatic. He urges Congress to get together. And this is in the final days of his administration, right? The final couple months. And it's very similar to what he did at the beginning of his administration, right? With the Tyler precedent, with the idea of having Senate and the House be joined as one. He says, do a joint resolution. And nobody believes it's going to work. There's this ferocious, lengthy debate, but March 1st, 1845, 3 days before leaving office, Tyler signs what essentially is a resolution that annexes Texas. We call this annexation by statute, which is a little different.
What was the justification used for just saying that was ours now?
Texas wanted the Lone Star Republic wanted to join the United States. But, and here's a good trivia question, because if you ask somebody, what was the state that Tyler added to on the last day of his presidency? Everybody says Texas. It's Florida. So his last
switcheroo.
His last day in office, he admits Florida to the Union, and he sets the fire for the Civil War because he added two slave states, and there was no Missouri Compromise. Now, Kyle,
yes,
I will speed run the end of his life.
Before that, did he try to run for re-election, or did he not even bother?
He never. I don't believe he ever wanted to run again. From what I read, so the reason Tyler doesn't run again is that he felt he was a man without a party. But more importantly, people knew he was a man without a party.
Well, he kind of spurned all the parties. Like, it's...
Exactly.
It's kind of on you.
And there was a little bit of this national embarrassment that Tyler felt because Tyler was the first president to have Congress overrule a veto. And, you know, that was considered quite embarrassing.
Right.
And you got... I don't know if you know, one of the funny parts, like, I don't know how you feel about this, Kyle, but Jackson was a big fan of the pocket veto, which is just not signing a piece of legislation until Congress falls out of session, so they can't override it.
Right.
So I do kind of give Tyler respect for the fact that he would sign it and say, if you can override it, you can override it.
Yeah.
He was a constitutionalist. He was.
Yeah. So, speed run the life, and then we can do some rankings here, huh?
Yeah. So... because I really don't like talking about, like, it's not as interesting as
redeemable here, is there? Yeah,
just... no, it gets worse and worse and worse.
Let's see. That's yeah.
So he leaves office on March 4th, 1845. He transfers power to James K. Polk. Texas annexation's in motion. He's done with the Whig Party. The Democratic Party's not really interested in him either because they kind of view him as a traitor. Because he was
kind of
just didn't stick with them, ran against them. He ends up retiring to Sherwood Forest, which is just outside Charles City County, Virginia.
Did you say Sherwood Forest?
Sherwood Forest, yeah.
Yeah, like with Sheriff of Nottingham?
Sherwood Forest. I looked this up. You can still go there.
Where is this?
It's in Charles City County, Virginia. It's it's southern Virginia. Huh. So he does that for 15 years, manages the plantation.
Does he live in a log cabin and drink hard cider?
No, because he was not nearly as baller as William Henry Harrison. So February 1861 rolls around, and they have the famous peace conference in D.C. and he presides over a gathering at the Willard Hotel. So he's presiding over the peace conference. And the whole idea of peace conference was to avert the Civil War. Now, it's 1861, so Mr. Lincoln's getting sworn in a month. And they proposed a compromise, which was extending the Missouri Compromise line and guaranteeing slavery in this essentially dual society. And everybody's, the Republicans are like, no. He's like, what about no? And they're like, what? No, we got elected. We finally got elected. We're abolitionists. This is no. And so he's like, and it's weird. Like, again, I don't want to speculate too much, but he's like, oh, you don't like my proposal? Well, how do you not? Because he's brilliant, but he's a very binary thinker. And it's weird to me that he doesn't understand the Republican point, which was also very binary. It was very like no slavery. And he's like, but no, you're also a binary. You can at least be like, oh, I understand. You're a binary thinker. I'm a binary thinker.
You have principles. Like, this is a morality issue.
Yeah, it must have been weird. Like, we have principles, and our principles are better because we are correct. Yes. So he comes back April 1861. The secession crisis is in full bloom, and he ends up serving as a delegate to Virginia's secession convention, votes for secession on April 4th of 1861, and again on April 17th, signs the Ordinance of Secession, and then is immediately elected to the Confederate Provisional Congress and later to the Confederate House of Representatives. He ends up, by 1862, heading to Congress, or the Confederate Congress. He's at the Exchange Hotel, and he suffers a massive stroke. He ends up having a Confederate state funeral, and he's interned at the Hollywood Cemetery. He's actually buried near James Monroe. He was not officially...
Confederate honors?
Yep. Never officially mourned by the U.S. government.
Really?
Yeah, and his coffin, he was buried with a coffin draped in the Confederate flag. So he ends up being a president who signs secession away from the Union. He is somebody who is, in his worst part, he's going to seem good compared to James K. Polk.
We got a few bad names we're coming up into here.
Oh, yeah. No, we have nothing good coming until Abraham Lincoln. No. Abraham Lincoln will cleanse the palate of the show. I'm really trying to think of a president I'm going to like at any point going through here.
Not even Zachary Taylor?
I don't think I have an issue with Zachary Taylor that we
will
get to.
I have no idea anything about him other than his name is Zach, and I think that's wild that we elected a Zach.
Yeah, he did some crazy stuff in the Mexican-American War. No, he was kind of funny because they kept thinking he was trying to like run for president or trying to have a political campaign. He was just like, no, I just like fighting war.
Right. All right, let's do some POTUS ranking for Mr. Tyler here. So I'll remind you how the patented POTUS scale ranking system here works. Half points are allowed. It's a scale of 1 to 7, or 0 to 7, actually. Honestly, it's really anything to 7.
We do fractionals,
yeah. Yeah, we do negatives, too. I've already pre-written one in here. So we start off with the P here, the political influence, president's ability to shape political landscape, including their impact on party dynamics, legislative agendas, and long-term political shifts.
Can your impact be horribly negative?
I think it can, especially if you get kicked out of your own party.
Like, have we given a president a negative yet in a category?
Hold, please.
I don't think we have.
I don't think so either.
He got kicked out of his party. He should have a negative. Like, right? Ceremonially, I want to give him a negative 3.5.
But did he impact any other parties?
Not really. The Whigs kind of ignored him. The Democrats kept doing their thing, and he was just kind of a president without a party.
Minus 3.5, that seems excessive, but all right.
Dude, he got thrown out of his own party. Yeah, right. That's crazy.
Overall governance. The effectiveness of his administration in implementing policies, managing the bureaucracy, and maintaining stability and governance. Okay, stability and governance, I think you need to give him points on that one.
Yeah, Tyler president's huge. Like, that's
managing
really worth a lot.
The bureaucracy, though, when your entire cabinet resigns, that's not a good look. I don't think that's a good sign of governance.
Can I be biased for a second?
Yeah.
The economy did recover during this time period with that much turmoil and a president dying in office.
Can I just say that this just speaks to the idea that the president and Congress need to not do anything. They just need to do as little as possible, and things tend to work out for the best.
Yeah, generally speaking, I believe that people make the best decisions for themselves.
Right.
This is the Austrian. I want to give him like a 5.5 or a 6. I really respect the fact that the Tyler president and not letting the economy slip back into recession.
What about his management of the bureaucracy, though? I mean, I guess he gave them the blueprints for what he wanted, but then he also still vetoed the thing when they came back and did what he wanted.
Yeah. Yeah,
it was a lot of vetoes.
It was a lot of vetoes. Let's drop it down to like a 5.
Okay. Yeah. All right, transformational leadership.
Oh, 0. 0.
Right. Ready to read it?
No, sorry. Read it for the people who are listening.
But... I'll just read this part. Did he address pressing societal issues and implement lasting change?
No.
Understanding of public needs. How well did he understand and respond to the needs and concerns of the American public? Did he engage with citizens and address their priorities effectively?
Oh, see, I have a hard one here because he believed in limited government was the solution. Oh, so there has to be a little contextualization of this.
Hmm. So he didn't believe in engaging with citizenry?
Yeah, he didn't really believe government was supposed to engage. And, like, I can't get over the fact the economy recovered. Okay, that's a hard one for me. Like, I want to say that's a good thing.
Things can be accidental. Just because you made the decisions that...
That's a good point.
You may not have actually made the right decisions. You may have accidentally stumbled your way into it.
So what would you put him at?
Understanding the public needs, if he doesn't ever talk to the public or think that he has any responsibility to him, I don't understand how you can understand him.
My thing is, I think he was like, the best thing for the people is for government to not be in their lives.
I like that.
But I don't know how that... This is a hard one. There's an argument that he's a 6, and there's also an argument that he's a 1.
Well, I think it's the understood and responded to the needs and concerns.
Oh, he didn't know. He didn't respond? No, that.
Yeah.
He
did. Okay. That guesses are out there.
Yeah. So, like 2.5, 3.
I was just going to say 2.5.
That's a 2.5.
Hilarious. Strategic vision. They examine the clarity and ambition of the president's vision for the country. Did they have a forward thinking approach that guided their decisions and inspired hope for the future?
Okay. So, no hope for the future.
I put -1 on there. If you vote for the, it's negative one. If you vote for secession as a former president,
yeah, no, you're a piece of crap.
Yeah.
I was going to say, the president's vision for the country was Western expansion, and he definitely lit the fight under Manifest Destiny. And
he did.
Added 2 states, but that was his vision. He essentially put the Civil War into, like, hardened the concrete of it. And if your job of being the president is to preserve the Union, you did a really bad job of that.
Right.
Like, if you went to John Tyler in 1843 and was like, hey, if you do you want more states or less states? And he was like, I want more states. Well, you're about to lose 13 of them.
Yeah, right.
And then you're about to get 13 back.
Yeah.
Whether you like it or not.
With about half the population.
When I was in Texas, one of the tour guides said to me, she's like, you know, Texas could leave and become a state under, you know, any time it wants to. And I was like, you tried that with 12 of your other buddies and it didn't work.
It didn't work.
And she was like, what do you mean? And I was like, you couldn't be in your own state. You and 12 of your friends tried to be other states, and a bunch of Northerners came here and were like, how would you like machinery and a stable economy? It's like, I don't want either. You're going to get both. Please leave me alone. You chose this. No, let's go -1, because, like, you can't vote
like that.
In secession.
So, total score for Tyler.
Like 12?
3.
3. That's fine. That makes sense.
That's my lucky number. I'm actually a little sad that he got that.
Okay, we can add an extra. We can add -1.5 for his.
Just to get him off of 3. It's a good spot to end our coverage on John Tyler Jr. So you can join us next week as we begin our coverage of James K. Polk. And while you're waiting for that, I'd like you to fill the comments with all the Polk puns that you think I should have used in the intro. You can email them to us at buckstartsherepodcast@gmail.com if you're worried about spoilers. Emancipate that thumbs up button and subscribe on your way out the door. Visit the website to stay up to date. We'll see you all next week. Produced by China Shop Productions.